Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this last day of January, the 31st. David K. Johnston, one of our favorite guests who knows everything you can imagine about tax codes and the history of tax codes and money, is our guest this hour. He is now a columnist for Reuters. He's a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist and author. His books include Free Lunch, How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense and Stick You with the Bill. And published later this year will be The Fine Print, How Big Companies Abuse Plain English and Other Tricks to Rob You Blind. David has said in recent columns, this is America's 100th year for individual income tax, a system he says is as out of touch with our era as digital music is with the hand-cranked Victrola music players of 1912. It's also the 26th year of the Reagan-era reform for both personal and corporate tax, a grand design that is now buried under special interest reforms. He calls for a debate. Should we tax individuals and corporate income or something else? He's also written about offshore accounts. He talks about one in four Americans earning low wages and where we place in terms of the world on that figure, and why it is that the share of American workers earning less than two-thirds of the median wage has been slowly increasing since 1980. David always has a lot to say. We always get a lot of phone calls for David. Here is our phone number, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Hello, David.
How are you?
I'm fine. How are you, David?
I'm just terrific.
Good, good. We always love having you on. You just have so much information that we ought to know and we don't know. So it's good to have you with us. Let's start with this 100th year for individual income tax. Why do you say this system is so out of touch?
Well, tax systems have to flow from the economic order. So if you live in an agrarian society, if you were an Egyptian in the time of the pharaohs, a Sumerian, what we now call Iraq, in the time of Hammurabi, the tax you paid was part of your crop that you grew. Once the world began to go to cash incomes from mass production work, we rapidly got income taxes. The British and the French in the late 1700s, the Japanese and the Germans in 1865, the U.S. From 1861 to 1872, and then again since 1913. And all of the tax systems that have been developed in the era of our modern income tax, 1913, were designed for the economy of that age, which was somewhat agriculture, but heavily moving towards large factories and people paid cash wages. And back then, people didn't even get checks. You got an envelope with your pay in it. Hmm. You went and stood in front of the paymaster and got in line and got your envelope. And now we have a system where people at the top, they don't get paid the way that you and I do. They don't have a paycheck. Many of the very wealthiest people get paid the way Romney gets paid. And the system is not designed to capture their economic gains. Basically, we have two tax systems in America, separate and unequal. One is for wage earners who are very efficiently taxed. They get taxed before they get paid. The other is for people who own their own businesses, are big investors, especially investors with international interests. And the system's rules really allow them to pay comparatively little in tax to their actual economic gain.
How does Romney get paid? Tell us about this whole deferred tax carried interest.
Well, Romney is part of a very narrow group of people who are the highest paid workers in the history of the world. They are managers of investment partnerships, hedge funds, which are basically unregulated mutual funds and speculators, hedge funds, private equity funds. That's what Romney was in, people who start and more often buy and sell businesses, and real estate partnerships. And if you're the manager of one of these funds, you get paid in two ways. It's commonly known as 2 and 20. You get 2% of the money people deposit with you each year as a fee, just like your mutual fund may charge you anywhere from 10 cents on $100 up to $1.50 or $2 per $100 as a management fee. Then you get a share of any profits that you earn. So if you buy a business with other people's money and it throws off a profit for the next 40 years, you get 20% of that profit. If it turns $1 billion a year, you get $200 million. But you don't pay taxes on the value of your stake in the company. That would be called a capital interest. You only pay it on your income. It's called a profits interest. And you, even though you don't have any money at risk, it's your customers' money that's at risk, you get the capital gains rate that we give, the 15% tax rate, to people who put their money at risk. So the guy who manages your mutual fund with your 401k, he gets taxed like you and I do. It's a salary, and he pays the top rate. But if you run a fund like Romney did, even though it's not his money either, it's just like the mutual fund, he's managing other people's money, he gets the lower rate.
Mm-hmm. And then what's the story with putting money in the Cayman Islands? How much money does he have there? How common is the practice? Why would you do that?
There's absolutely nothing improper or illegal about Romney being in the Cayman Islands. Lots of things are done in the Cayman Islands that I've written about and others have that are improper and nefarious. That's not the case here. And here's the reason. Romney starts a fund to buy American Widget. And you and I decide to invest in it, so we write a check, no issue. But what if your grandmother in Italy or Poland or Japan wants to invest? Well, if she invests like we do, she has to fill out an American tax return. And you don't want to do that. Just as you and I, if we buy tax in Luxottica, the Italian eyeglass maker, we don't want to fill out an Italian tax return. So instead, foreigners invest in a Cayman Islands company, which then invests in Romney's fund here in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
Likewise, pension funds, whether it's the Wisconsin State Employees Pension Fund, and I don't know that they did this, just as an example, or the Harvard Endowment, if they invest in a fund like this, which uses borrowed money to enhance and leverage the investment, they have to pay taxes right away on any investment gains. But if they go to the Cayman Islands and invest in the same company with the foreigners, then that rule does not apply, and their gains continue to be tax-free.
I see.
And then Romney gets a share of those profits, and he fully reports them, and they're properly disclosed.
When did we get this whole system? Was it part of changes in 1980, David?
It's essentially been around since the beginning of the system.
Really?
But it was of no big economic consequence until we began turning everything into a financial product. It's really become a big issue in the last, 10, 15 years.
Mm-hmm. You write about five ancient principles about money and democracy, and I'm wondering how we've reached a point where people, some people in this country, would question the progressive tax system. The moral principle of progressive taxation, you say that the greater the gain you manage to attain, whether it's through hard work or luck, the greater your duty to pay it back to the society that made you rich so that it will endure. Do we still adhere to that?
Well, we do up to a point. We have a tax system that is progressive up to $8 or $10 million of income statistically, and then it falls off, and people above that pay much lower rates. The top 400 taxpayers in 2008, 30 of them, and this is a group, by the way, made almost $1 million a day, 30 of them had an effective tax rate of under 10%, and it may well be that some of them paid nothing. The IRS won't say, because there's such a small group, they're afraid it'll identify somebody. But it's entirely possible, and I would say likely, that at least some of those 30 people paid no income taxes at all.
And the rationale for that would be that they would be stimulating the economy somehow?
The rationale for it is that they and people who think like them make big campaign contributions, and they rent members of Congress.
What does anybody do with that kind of money, David? Really, what do you do with it?
Well, you can't consume that kind of income. And I have a little game I play with people called, you know, consumption. And very few people are able to actually consume more than about $800,000 a year when you play this game. You want to buy a house, that's not consumption. That's just turning one asset, a dollar bill, into another, a house. But people at that level, they're not consuming. They are reinvesting in other businesses. And you know, years ago, Sherry Lansing, the first woman to run a studio in Hollywood, gave an interview to the New York Times about her money. The story said she was worth $100 million, and I remember laughing at the time. Yeah, right, she's worth $100 million. That's like saying I'm worth $2. She's worth much more than that. And she said that she had nightmares all the time that she would be a bag lady.
Oh, my.
Some people with that kind of money, you know, it affects their view of the world. They need more and more and more because their relationship with their money is not healthy. They apparently haven't watched Susie Orman.
what are the consequences of all those people paying nothing or next to nothing on huge amounts of money? What are we losing out?
Well, we're losing tens of billions of dollars a year of income. And, you know, one of the arguments, Kathleen, for the 15% rate is that it's supposedly double taxation. That is, you invest in a company like General Electric or Apple, and it's taxed, and then in turn you're taxed. The problem is many of the enterprises set up by people like Romney and other hedge fund and private equity managers are organized as what are called pass-through entities. They don't pay taxes. LLCs, subchapter S corporations, partnerships. The Koch brothers use a lot of these LLCs. And so the only tax paid is that 15%. And this is just sheer political power. It has nothing to do with good economics. It has nothing to do with building a sound economy. It has to do with the political pull of this group of people. And let me give you just an example of how different they are from the rest of business. It has been a dream of American capitalists to be able to write off immediately for tax purposes any new investment that they make. In 1954, they got the right to have what's called accelerated depreciation, to write off for tax purposes things faster than they do for shareholder purposes. Because you buy a machine that stamps metal, it might have a 30-year life. So you write it off over 30 years. Well, under President Obama, businesses got a 50% bonus write-off,
wow.
And then last year they had a 100% write-off. If you were a business owner and you went out and built a $1 billion factory last year, you got to write off the whole $1 billion right now. It's impossible for a president who allowed that to be considered anti-business.
Mm-hmm.
Where is the claim that Obama wants to destroy business coming from? It's coming from the people who benefit from this system who pay very little taxes, the hedge fund managers, Wall Street, the private equity managers, because they would end up paying the same kind of rate that investors of other kind in other businesses pay.
So when the president is talking about taxing millionaires at a 30% rate, that's just a drop in the bucket. He should be looking at what you just described.
Oh yeah, we need comprehensive tax reform. And I've been all this year in my column at Reuters, I'm going to be showing ways we can do this. There is, for example, no reason for more than 100 million of the 140 billion people who file a tax return to file a tax return. And if you're a wage earner or a retiree who's not fabulously wealthy, doesn't own businesses, and you live in any other modern country, you don't have to file a tax return. The government knows already everything you need to know. Your income is reported, your bank interest is reported, all of this is reported to the government. And what the government could do is simply send you a notice saying, here's the record we have. If it's right, then your tax has been withheld and it's paid, or here's a check because you overpaid, or you owe us a check for this. And if you disagree, fill out a tax return. Well, who's fighting that tooth and nail? The man who holds himself out as the taxpayer's best friend, Grover Norquist.
Hmm.
And why? Well, because if people weren't angry about the time they waste and the money they waste, roughly for working class people, $22 billion a year, I figure, dealing with the tax system, how would he build political support for what he's really seeking, which is a tax-free world for the capitalist class, which is what Newt Gingrich is proposing, by the way. Under Newt Gingrich's tax plan, Romney would pay no taxes. No person who is wealthy and lives off their investments would ever pay taxes again.
Do you imagine that we're going to see, it's been a long time since we've done an examination of this whole system, are we at some point going to see an examination, a serious examination of all the intricacies of the tax code in this country, or is it so highly filled with lobbyists and the situation politically is so partisan in this country that, forget it, we'll never have people sit at the table and say, let's fix this?
That's up to the American people. If they want to continue to outsource citizenship and not say, I don't want to get involved in politics, I don't care about this, then nothing is going to change. But if members of Congress hear from their constituents that they want an updated and modern and streamlined system that is fair, and they vote out of office a lot of people who have made it clear, they've signed pledges, I will never raise taxes, doesn't matter what the reason is. Even if raising taxes on means you may actually end up paying lower taxes or save money, then I don't see that we will have any change. If we don't fix this system, our whole economy must fail eventually. It may take a long time, but it has to fail. A tax system must flow from the economic order to succeed. We have a tax system now which throws sand in the gears of commerce instead of lubricating them.
We're going to go to phone calls. Our lines are filled, as you can imagine. David K. Johnston is our guest. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. David has also written, and I don't think very much attention is paid to people who work, but whose wages are very, very low in this country, and it's a huge number of Americans. I'd like to address that with David as well as we continue this hour, and we'll begin taking your phone calls momentarily. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Today, of course, is the Florida primary, and we will have NPR coverage starting at 7 o'clock tonight on the Ideas Network. And tomorrow, Santorum, of course, had an unofficial win in Iowa. Romney took New Hampshire. Gingrich clutched a victory in South Carolina's GOP primary. So after today, the voters in Florida casting their ballots, and polls are showing Romney with a substantial lead. Tomorrow after 9, we will have guests join us from NPR member station WFSU in Tallahassee to discuss the results of the primary from the Sunshine State. So that we'll have a political reporter from Florida Public Radio and an assistant professor of political science at Florida State University. David K. Johnston, Pulitzer Prize winning journalist and author, columnist for Reuters, is our guest this hour. And we start our calls with Laverne from Monroe. Hi, Laverne.
Hello, Kathleen. This is a great program.
Thanks, Laverne.
Hello, Mr. Johnston. It's an honor to talk to you.
Well, I'm glad to talk to you, Mr. Laverne.
We have a growing debt, and any conservative should realize you can't keep doing this forever. That's why I think that you should raise the state income tax on the individual, a federal income tax on the individual up to at least 40% to pay for the growing debt. Capital gains should probably be at least 30%. And I also think maybe why couldn't you tax the hedge funds and the derivative dealers? That also would bring a lot of money. I understand President Obama said at one time he wanted to tax the hedge funds.
Well, Laverne, you're quite correct about President Obama. He wants to get rid of this thing called the carried interest deal for the hedge fund managers. Congress has been unwilling to do that, and that's because the hedge fund managers have, through both themselves and proxies, people acting on their behalf, contributed a lot of money to Congress and spent a lot of money lobbying. And remember, we have organizations like the Club for Growth that go after, it's a Republican organization, if you don't hew their line on taxes, they will raise money from their wealthy supporters and go after you and get rid of you in office. And they've done it to people, so they've scared a lot of people who are more interested in keeping their job in Congress than doing what they may think is the right thing to do. Fundamentally, however, this little issue about the debt, it's important to understand, and there are columns of mine at Reuters that explain this. The U.S. government cannot go broke, and that's because the U.S. government has monopoly control of its own currency. Any government with monopoly control of its currency cannot, by definition, go broke. It can make you and me go broke. It can ultimately produce a situation in which you might have a revolution, but it can't go broke. And while we need to levy in line with what we spend, the reason that we are so deeply in debt is for the last 30-some years, Congress has not been taxing as much as it's been spending. All of the Bush tax cuts were financed with borrowed money. The only war that I can find in history financed without raising taxes is the U.S. war in Iraq and in Afghanistan, neither of which, by the way, were declared by Congress, as the Constitution requires. And right now, and there's a video of mine at Reuters you can see about this, right now, if we cut government spending, we will go into a severe economic downturn because spending equals income. Income equals spending. If private spending goes down, which is what's happened, spending by businesses and individuals and nonprofits, if government doesn't make up for that spending, then incomes must fall. This is basic algebra. It's taught every economic student. It's called an accounting identity. 1 + 1 must equal 2 if you're in base 3 or larger.
Thanks, Laverne, for your call. Joel in Janesville. Hi.
Hi. I would like to, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
But I would propose just wiping out entirely the income tax from individuals and corporations in favor of using a sales tax so that when people have the money to spend, that's when they would pay their taxes. You would exempt things like food, medicine, childcare items. But it's not just goods, but you'd also tax services. And so when businesses outsource and when even up to financial transactions, when the rich buy their stocks and bonds or when companies decide to use their profits to buy back their stock or to buy options for their CEOs, they would also pay their tax.
David?
Well, the design that you're proposing cannot work, and there's just innumerable pieces written by tax economists explaining why this won't work. But let me deal with the most widely known version of this, which is called the fair tax. Its primary promoter is a radio talk show host, not put down radio talk show host.
Please. Thank you, David.
But you don't hold yourself out as a tax expert, and his
no.
billionaire backer. And here's what I believe would happen if we went to a national retail sales tax. It would encourage people who now slip in. We would replace the people who now furtively slip into buildings to buy drugs with people furtively slipping into buildings to buy anything they could, diamond rings, winter coats, to avoid paying the tax. And it would inevitably lead to pressure to ban cash and require that everything be purchased digitally, which would mean then that there'd be a record of where you were and what you spent. And would you like to have somebody suing you or your spouse if you're estranged have access to that kind of information and don't believe that it wouldn't be available? It also would radically shift the burden of taxes down. Very wealthy people don't buy lots of things. That's why they're wealthy. They don't need to spend all their income in order to live. They spend, in many cases, a tiny, tiny fraction of their income, an infinitesimal share of 1% on their lifestyle. So that's it just fundamentally, that doesn't work. That doesn't mean we couldn't have a consumption tax, which would be best done through something called a subtraction method value-added tax, and every other modern economy has one. And I think that when you're paying for the services people get through the efficiency of government, universal pension plans and old age medical care, that's an appropriate thing to do.
Thank you, Joel, very much for your call. Let's go to an email from Brett. The top marginal tax rate decades ago was 91%, capital gains 30%. Much more of the nation's tax revenue was from corporations. These were in effect during the 50s and 60s. Doesn't this disprove the Republicans' claim that higher taxes on the rich and corporations will destroy the economy, especially after the last 12 years of extremely low taxes, not translating into jobs and economic gains?
Well, I don't think a marginal 91% tax rate is a very good idea at all. I think that's way too high and unreasonable, although it is indeed what we had. And the result was these rampant tax shelters that nobody paid these taxes in reality, except maybe Ronald Reagan, who always claimed he actually paid the 91% rate.
Did he really?
He asserted that he paid that rate. He certainly, let me put it this way, he certainly strongly implied that he did.
Uh-huh.
Kind of hard to believe, but maybe he had bad tax advisors. There's a lot of research coming out by economists showing that if the corporate tax rate was as high, it's now 35% on paper, were as high as 65%, it would not discourage investment and business. And right now, American non-financial businesses have more than $10,000 in cash for every man, woman, and child in the country. That they're just holding on to the cash.
Mm-hmm.
And Why are they doing that? Because there's no demand, because people aren't buying goods and services. Therefore, you just hold on to your cash and wait for the day in the future when you think that you'll be able to invest that profitably. And we face really big economic challenges. If we're going to have this global economy, then, you know, the trend line has been very clear for a long time. We are heading towards lower and lower incomes for people who are not in the handful of businesses, financial investments being one of them. And you're going to see on a worldwide basis, you know, a lowering of our incomes and a raising of incomes in places like China until they get closer to an equilibrium. This is the most one of the most basic principles in economics. We certainly, I think, on the marginal income should raise have higher rates. But here's something to think about. The top earned income rate in the U.S., the ordinary rate, what people pay on their wages, starts when you're making under $400,000. We have people whose compensation is over $100 million a year, and they pay the same rate. Why don't we have a super rate for people who make more than $10 million and a super rate for people who make more than $50 million or $100 million? It seems to me people who make $400,000 a year have nothing in common with people who make $10 million or $100 million a year economically, and they should not be taxed at the same rate.
Yeah. Let's go back for a moment to those companies holding on to that enormous amount of money. Aren't there certain kinds of industries? We've talked a lot about green energy, about the wave of the future in certain kinds of high-tech industry. Why wouldn't you release, invest some of that money that you have to, that you've got some kind of sense that you're doing the right thing when you're investing money, and wouldn't you make a profit in an industry that everybody says is going to be booming pretty soon?
ExxonMobil, when oil finally is gone, ExxonMobil will not turn out to be a wind energy company. Xerox, inventor of the, to this day, when you adjust for inflation, the most successful machine in business machine in history, the Xerox 941, did not convert itself into a successful maker of computers and the thing they invented, the graphical interface we all use to click on the computers. The New York Times Company, which once owned the worldwide exclusive rights to fax machines, which were invented in the 1800s, could never figure out how to make money off them. And so either sold or gave up those rights. A company that's in business A doesn't go into business B. I have a business with my sons. We manage a hotel and a lodging house. I would have no idea how to go into the green energy business. That's not our business. And so these businesses are going to reinvest in their own business when there's demand. And if they don't, I would argue that what they should be doing is paying out big dividends. I mean, right now, Apple should have over $100 billion of cash. And the reasonable thing for investors, if you can't find a better way to invest it, then pay it out in dividends and let people pay their 15%.
Hmm. What do you make of those Apple stories in China, David?
Well, the New York Times, where I used to be a reporter, has been doing these excellent stories about how they essentially have slave labor in the Foxconn factories. People aren't technically slaves, but they live there in the company. The company feeds them. They work them horrendous hours. There have been people who've committed suicide because they couldn't take it and they couldn't get out. And Apple says, we're going to look into this. Well, I'm sorry, you were supposed to be looking into this from the beginning. You were required by American law and our trade agreements to be looking into this. And there's a long history of this. You'll remember when Kathy Lee discovered, because somebody went out and did the work, that literally child labor, and effectively child slave labor, was making clothing with her name on it. She, at least, after some prodding, took some action and said, this isn't right. Apple is trying to deny this, and why we are not enforcing the rules and stopping the destruction of American jobs to be replaced by jobs that are essentially slave labor in China is just beyond me. And the only explanation I can think of is the financier class, who are the people who mostly benefited from world trade after the working poor of China and other poor Asian countries. They don't want that to happen because it would cut into their very low-taxed or untaxed profits.
There's something deeply wrong with all of that, David.
There is, and people have to make noise about it. That's the whole point of democracy, is that we get to rule ourselves. And as Aristotle taught, democracy is to rule and be ruled in turns. That is, your group gets to run the government now, then somebody else gets to run the government, and you need to think about that so that you run a government that, even under your opponents, is something you can live with.
John in Milwaukee, hi.
Hi. I have always thought of the Defense Department as kind of an insurance policy similar to homeowners insurance. And just maybe a month or so ago, there was an article in the Wall Street Journal where somebody discussed switching over from an income tax to an asset tax. And when I think of the Defense Department as like homeowners insurance, that would make sense, that if people had more assets for the Defense Department to be protecting, like having a second home or a larger home than the other guy, that assets would be a valid way to go. In the article, he mentioned that he would expect to see a minimum of $3 million in assets accumulated before you would have to pay any taxes on your assets. And it seems like that seemed like a viable way to go. But I was curious if you saw the article and what you thought of it.
Well, I haven't seen that article, but this actually has a long history. The reason that we got the estate tax was to pay for World War One, and at the time, the leading tax economist in America, Edwin Seligman, said that if we're going to have the conscription of young men, then we should have a conscription of wealth. So this is a long-held concept. Here's the problem with a wealth tax. Just think about the disputes people have over property taxes and how much your house is worth. Now, if you own a portfolio of publicly traded securities, stock in Ford Motor and Harley Davidson, the government can figure out how much wealth you have. But how do you figure out the wealth of my little business with my son? And it's a really tiny business, 25 employees at the peak of the year, with my sons. I can present that business, if I were trying to sell it, as being worth a lot of money. But to the tax man, I can show that it's maybe a liability. It has no value. Our tools for measuring wealth are very, very inadequate. And so I think it's very difficult to do that. In fact, the carried interest, the source of Mr. Romney's income, the government says if you give your carried interest, say, to your children, as it appears Mr. Romney has done, he won't say, but it appears from the record that's what he's done, as long as they hold on to it for more than 2 years, you may value it at zero. Now, it may be the right to collect $100 million a year for forever, but we value it at zero under certain circumstances if you follow certain technical rules.
Hi. Thanks, John, for your call. Laura in New Berlin. Hi.
Hi. Thank you both for this excellent program. For some of these businesses that were mentioned earlier, for instance, LLCs, is there a way for a citizen to learn the identity of the humans behind these businesses and also get access to the financial statements? So in other words, what are the disclosure requirements and what kind of access can an interested citizen get? Thank you.
Thank you, Laura.
Boy, that's a great question, Laura. Thank you. Reuters has just been doing a series on this very issue, and there's a house at 2710 Thomas Avenue in Cheyenne, Wyoming, almost within sight of the state capitol, that is the home to over 2,000 corporations.
Ooh.
And under Wyoming law, and this is also true in Nevada and Delaware and some other states, you can create a corporation. You can go set up a company for you, Kathleen, and your name would never appear on it. The company there will provide you with a board of directors and a CEO and a lawyer so that you can do everything through attorney-client privilege. And the only way I could ever find out that you owned the company is if I got into some kind of litigation and persuaded a judge that I needed to know who owned the company and got the judge to make the company produce the Wyoming company in that house, the records of your company. It has been pointed out by various lawyers in other countries that if you are a terrorist who wants to finance some serious attack on the United States, the single most efficient way to do so is to set up a company in Wyoming or Nevada and put money into it and then fund your operation. And you will be invisible. You'll even be invisible to the U.S. government's electronic surveillance if you do it right.
When did all this come about?
Oh, this has been around for years and years and years, and this was done in the name of we need to reduce regulation of business. We have too much regulation of business. If you look at a world analysis, there have been several of them done, of the regulation of business, when it comes to employees, there's a bar chart I've seen by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, which is the U.S. and 33 other modern economies. And the bar chart, everything goes to the right as far as your computer screen is. And the U.S., you can just barely see the tiny little line. When you look at other regulations, the U.S. regulation of business is so minimal compared to other countries. It is extraordinary. And a lot of that regulation in the U.S. actually enhances profits. It makes more money. By the way, business has always been regulated. I teach the history of business regulation at the law and business schools at Syracuse University. And the very first thing I start off doing is we go through Hammurabi's Code. Hammurabi's Code, almost 4,000 years ago, regulated lending, safety and home construction, management of other people's property, trusts. There's a special rule for tavern owners if they're women. Business has always been regulated.
That might be worth a talk show, Hammurabi's Code, huh?
Well, I hope eventually to make a TV documentary out of this.
Really?
Stuff. Yeah.
Good for you. David K. Johnston, our guest this hour, Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist and author. He's a columnist now for Reuters. He's author of Free Lunch, How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense and Stick You with the Bill, and forthcoming, The Fine Print, How Big Companies Abuse Plain English and Other Tricks to Rob You Blind. We're talking about taxes with David this hour of the program, and our lines are filled right now. But keep the number in your head, 800-486-8655. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program, Patricia Cohen, who's written a fascinating book about middle age, In Our Prime, The Invention of Middle Age. She looks at the history, actually, and goes way, way back, but the majority of the book is the concept of middle age from its development at the end of the 19th century to its present position at the center of America's culture and also as the engine of a multi-billion dollar economy. So she will be with us. Second hour of the program today. David K. Johnston is our guest now. Alan in Appleton, hello.
Hi. I actually just have been receiving calls to the very thing you were just talking about with trying to structure a business of state. I got a call probably 6 months ago from somebody, and somehow that information got out, so I've been getting these calls repeatedly from all these different companies. And I said, basically, you know, to my understanding, it's basically a tax shelter, and from a moral standpoint, it's the wrong thing to do. And this woman that I was talking to, she said, well, yeah, but this company, and she named all these big Fortune 500 companies, they all do this. And I said, yeah, and they're all fraud, committing fraud towards the government, so they don't have to pay their fair share. So, and then I finally had to hang up on her for the second time in one day. So that was my comment. And,
Alan, the real scandal is they're not committing fraud. The problem is the real scandal, it's not venality. It's that the law allows these things. When you read the General Electric doesn't pay taxes, which the New York Times reported last year, and it wasn't news, by the way. I'd reported it years earlier. Forbes had reported it for the previous year. What they're doing is legal.
Yeah,
it's the law that allows them to do it.
Morally, I think it's morally bankrupt.
Yes.
Maybe that's
yes.
the right way of putting it.
I agree with you 100%. It's morally indefensible.
Thanks very much for your call. Tim in Milwaukee, hi.
Good morning. Actually, it's a very interesting program. Maybe this will tie a couple of things together in terms of the origin of taxes and Hammurabi's Code and so forth, but a lot of people are not aware that the reason we have the United States Constitution is at the end of the Revolutionary War, which wasn't funded through taxes, they had the Articles of Confederation, and they said, gee, we don't have any way of funding any of these things that we're deciding to do. So that was the all for the Constitutional Congress, and a lot of folks who are died in the, you know, no tax me type bits would be interested to know that the origin of.
All right, you're cutting out a little bit, but I think we got the theme.
Yeah, and unfortunately, I missed the caller's name, Kathleen. But, you know, that's a really important point Americans need to understand. We live in the Second American Republic. You know, the French tell you they live in the Fifth Republic. We live in the Second Republic. The first one failed because under the Articles of Confederation, there was no power to tax. And Edmund Burke, the British philosopher and politician who was the founder of modern conservatism, in his famous letter in 1793 wrote, "The revenue of the state is the state." And we also, in line with his history lesson, should remember something else. The Boston Tea Party was not a protest against high taxes. It couldn't have been because the colonists were paying 1/50, 2% as much in taxes as people were in the mother country. It was a protest against a tax exemption for the biggest company in the world and the imposition of a monopoly, sort of like what we're seeing today.
Hmm. Thanks, Tim, very much for the call. Before we take more phone calls, I just don't think we pay enough attention, and I'm glad that you do, to those people who work in this country, and there are many of them, 1 in 4 Americans earning low wages, less than $11 an hour. Only South Korea, you write, has a larger share of its workers in low-wage jobs. There have been attempts to help them with taxes, the earned income tax credit, but you wrote in a column recently about the problems with that. My question to you is, how do we lift people, and why isn't anybody talking about this, from those very low-income jobs, through better jobs or a tax structure or something, that they can have a decent life?
One of the biggest, most troublesome problems we have. 25% of Americans are in low-wage jobs, which generally don't come with any health benefits, whereas everywhere else in the modern world, those other 33 modern countries, you automatically have health care. You have, therefore, all sorts of pathologies and difficulties that grow out of this. So long as we have our current rules on world trade, I'm not against world trade, just the rules that we have at the moment, people with minimal skills are going to have a tough time. We, I think, have to get away from this notion that everybody should go to college. There are lots of people who would be better off if they were trained and had the opportunity to do other kinds of work that doesn't require a college education. On the other hand, our smartest and best minds, we need to be investing a great deal more in and enhancing the quality of education. We have this very strange policy in America where, and I have students in my classes who come here from Korea or Japan or China, and then once they graduate, they have to go home. And it's like, I'm sorry, if you're a top engineering student or a top biomedical student, why would we send you home? Mm-hmm. Why don't you stay here and enhance the economy here instead of taking the knowledge back to where you're from? We need to have a real serious discussion. Part of my column on the earned income tax credit, and what I'm about to say will drive liberals crazy, is raising the question of whether the design of the earned income tax credit, an idea that came from Milton Friedman and was championed by Ronald Reagan, actually increases poverty for those people who don't qualify by flooding the market with single mothers with minimal job skills and therefore reducing the wages of the people they compete against. And there's data showing this tremendous increase in single mothers going to the workforce because we eliminated welfare as we know it during the Clinton years. And that's, I believe, driven down wages.
So what do we do? How do we? That's a huge number of Americans, 1/4 of the population.
Right. Well, remember that half of all workers in America make less than $500 a week. Doesn't matter how many jobs they work. That's what their job pays. And a third, 51 million, make less than $15,000. And the average among that third is $6,000, which tells you a lot of them are part-time workers.
Right.
Only 1 in 4 American workers makes over $50,000 a year. Only 1 in 100 makes over $200,000 a year. So these are, they're huge numbers. One of the things that's happened in America is we have all these two-income families. When I was a young father in the late 60s and early 70s, I could afford to have a stay-at-home wife and a bunch of kids.
Mm-hmm.
Today, in the same circumstances, I couldn't buy the house I bought then. I couldn't do that. And in fact, my wife and I both work.
Right. Yeah, it's a whole different
And for people who are at the low end of the pay scale, it's really, really, including some of my relatives, so I'm very aware of this, it's really tough. If you're both making $8 an hour even and don't have kids, it's really tough to get by.
Mm-hmm. Patricia in Madison, hi.
Good morning. Very interesting program. I guess I've been bothered by Mitt Romney being used as your example or whipping boy here as far as wealth goes. You have not mentioned Warren Buffett, who has revealed his tax rate but not his returns. And when he dies, of course, his money is all going to go to the, at least it's been stated, to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, which means his estate won't be taxed again.
Well, first of all, I'm the guy who originally said Buffett's tax return is going to turn out to be just a hair over 17%. And then when he acknowledged all of this a few years ago and has done more since then, that was quite right. Buffett is a really good example, but he's a different example. Buffett has almost all of his fortune in the stock of Berkshire Hathaway, a holding company that owns, you know, Geico Insurance and MidAmerican Electric and PacifiCorp Electric and a lot of other companies and insurance companies. And it doesn't pay a dividend. So as his wealth increases, he can borrow against it if he needs to. He can use that to buy other investments or live on it if he wanted to, although he has an income of, I think it's $60 million a year, somewhere in that range. But he's different. His businesses are generally C corporations, and they're actually taxed. If you're giving your money away, I don't have actually any problem with giving your money away, because after all, you're giving it up. There will be an enduring public benefit because this will be a permanent endowment at the Gates Foundation. Not all of it, most of the money that will come from Mr. Buffett will be spent down, and it'll be used for public purposes and public benefit. The more interesting tax return, by the way, is the tax return of Newt Gingrich, who appears to have used the same device that John Edwards did, and which, if audited, he would probably lose on, of not paying the payroll tax by declaring most of the income from his business to be a dividend.
Uh-huh.
Our little family, tiny family business, 90% of it's owned by my son, and we don't use that because our tax advisor said you're subject to audit, and it's the rule isn't clear, but you shouldn't do it.
Thanks, Patricia, for your call. We go to Phil in McHenry, Illinois. Hi, Phil.
Good morning. I just have a quick question for you. The Wall Street Journal recently had a graph that said in the last campaign cycle, including President Obama, 48% of the funding for the campaigns came from mutual funds and hedge fund managers. My question is, how can we talk about tax code change when this parasitic thing, the campaign funding, is living off of that? Isn't one, in fact, the other? Don't they both have to be dealt with at the same time?
That's a good question.
Yeah. I didn't see that chart, and although there's a very narrow group of people who finance campaigns, find it a little hard to believe, particularly because Obama raised so much of his money from little donors. That was a big revolution in the 2008 election. But this is a fundamental problem. I mean, I believe we should do the following. We should have public financing of elections, or we should require television stations as part of their broadcast license to provide time at cost instead of the highest possible rate. In the two states where we've had public funding, Maine and Arizona, the fear that this would help the incumbents didn't work out. It turned out that the incumbents were more likely to be thrown out than anywhere else in the country. But money in politics is a real serious problem. I think that we need to fundamentally address these rules. Unfortunately, Citizens United, which is to the expansion of corporate power what the singularity was to the universe, it's the entire universe. What the Big Bang was to the singularity, the entire universe, really gets in the way of that, because the radical Supreme Court we have, and I do mean radical, they're ahistorical. They literally make up history, as Justice Breyer has pointed out. They have said dollars equal speech, and the founders, who tightly controlled corporations and didn't trust them, they would be absolutely astounded at that.
Mark, we have less than a minute left. Mark.
I wonder if you could just touch upon the business of people hoarding cash, but what we're using is debt for money. So if we actually controlled the currency by way of the Department of Treasury, as opposed to bleeding off the interest payments to a private sector, that interest would go right back into the state, and then it would become our money supply in such a way that it isn't bleeding us and causing this hoarding phenomena that we see.
We have about 30 seconds, David.
Yeah, we're seeing the hoarding because there's no place to successfully invest the money. The Federal Reserve actually turns over $70 or $80 billion a year in profits to the federal government, but I think it would be more appropriate if we directly ran our central bank instead of outsourcing it, which is what we've been doing since 1913. It's worked, in my view, reasonably well, but I think it should probably be direct instead of outsourced.
David, can't ask for a better guest than you. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, David. David K. Johnston, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. He is an author. He's a columnist now for Reuters, and you should go Google his name, Reuters, because the columns are really, really thought-provoking. We thank him for being with us. Tomorrow during this time period today, as you well know by now, is the Florida primary. We're going to have two guests with us, a political reporter from Florida Public Radio and also an assistant professor of political science at Florida State University to give us an analysis of the results from the primary in the Sunshine State. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for on-air production in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. We'll return.